Good evening, Africa, and welcome to Upfront from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. This week on Upfront,
second night was actually, he was even more lively. Yeah, it looked like the first night was warming up.
Wizkid is currently on his Made in Lagos global tour. And what's the deal with Facebook and all these social media platforms?
Right now, the federal government is suing Facebook, Google, other tech companies under antitrust laws. And the claim there is the companies are simply so big that they're dangerous to the larger economy and society.
What's up, Africa? You are listening to Upfront on the Voice of America.
There is no doubt that Wizkid is the preeminent prince of Afrobeat. And this year, 2021, he's actually having a great year. His song Essence, featuring the very talented Tems, reached number one on Billboard's R&B hip-hop airplay chart. Billboard called it a milestone achievement for the Afrobeats genre. And Wizkid is currently on his global tour for that album, Made in Lagos Tour. And he made a stop here in Silver Spring, in the suburbs of Washington, D.C. Silver Spring is home to a vibrant immigrant community that makes for a perfect location for a cultural institution like the Fillmore. Wizkid sold out that venue for two shows, which came as no surprise since he recently sold out the iconic O2 Arena in London in just 2 minutes. The Fillmore was the third stop in his 17-day tour, which will end next year in January of 2022. The previous three nights, he had performed for thousands in Brooklyn, New York, and went on to perform for thousands more in Chicago and other cities. Silver Spring is also home to my next guest, Tuma Bassa. Tuma attended the concert. Matter of fact, he went twice. But Tuma is not your regular concert goer. He's also a trailblazer in the global music industry. He's currently the director of Black Music and Culture at YouTube. He joins me to chat about the influence of Afrobeat on global culture, the power of the diaspora cultural consumer, which, by the way, I read a statistic that the combined buying power, that's the consumption power of Blacks, Asian Americans, and Native Americans, is estimated to be $2.4 trillion. I would be curious to know how much of that represents the African diaspora. But that's a conversation for another day. Welcome, Tuma.
How did it feel for you to finally get back to live concerts after a year of mostly virtual events?
So that was my first real show. So that it was in the beginning, it was a little awkward in terms of like comfort level and all those people. And we kept our masks on most of the time, you know, so we were singing through our masks. At the end of the night, my mouth was dry. So it's a transition, but it's like a happy transition, because that was a part. In the height of the pandemic, we weren't sure if things were ever going to come back to live shows and everything. We weren't sure if it was going to stay live stream permanently. Mm-hmm. So for me, it was a welcome, and it was a great night.
Even with the masks on, it did not kill the energy in the room.
Oh, not at all. Not at all. And by the way, most of the people weren't wearing masks. It's just that we're more cautious. And the other thing about the show was everyone was close together. We haven't been that close together in a long time, in a very long time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. How did Wizkid do?
I thought he did great. I went two nights in a row. So I posted that show was so nice. I went twice, right? And second night was actually, he was even more lively. He it looked like the first night was warming up. For that's talent for a show that great to almost be like the warm up.
Let's talk about the business side of it. This was a difficult time for artists around the world, but more so those in developing countries, developing economies. How did African artists survive during COVID? As a person who understands a little bit about the money side, the business side of it, what impact did the pandemic have on the industry?
Well, during COVID, every service was figuring out the monetization of live streaming. And so that revenue flow did exist. The hard part is if you do the same show in different cities, right? And then you do that show once to the whole world, it's hard to replicate, you know? So some people's business models is doing the same show multiple times in different places, right? And then you make more money that way. So sometimes it's a little harder if you do a show and you can't do it again because the whole world had access to it or the whole world saw it. So that's the tricky part of where we are right now with live stream technology and when it comes to monetization. But there are also alternative monetization. Like with YouTube, you have super chats or super stickers where yeah, you're going to monetize during VOD, but the fans can show support. They can express love. Almost like the way if you go to a Nigerian wedding and they're throwing dollars, throwing stickers at the artist, and they paid for those stickers. And those stickers, right now it's called alternative monetization. Maybe one day it'll be the mainstream monetization.
Right. During the time when they were not able to perform into the Hall of 2020, many concerts, I remember by March of 2020, the Fillmore had booked about 5 acts. Mr. Easy, yeah. I think it was Burna Boy, and a bunch of other artists, the Joe Boys, all those up and coming artists that had just had a hit in 2019. And 2020 came, they closed, they canceled all their concerts. How did they survive? Are there other revenue streams that are non-musical or musical in a way where they're still making money?
But I mean, the artists that you just mentioned are big artists. So they're going to make good money off of publishing. Because you have to remember, artists have multiple streams of revenue. Did they make money off of royalties or streaming, et cetera, et cetera? They make money off of live. They make brand sponsorship deals. They have large social media followings and can exercise
and that ability. And they can leverage that. Influencer.
Yeah, they can leverage that. Like, hey, you know, if I'm like Pepsi pays them to post themselves drinking Pepsi and wiping their forehead, you know what I mean? So the artists you mentioned are all big names and have multiple streams of revenue.
Right.
Multiple streams
of
revenue.
Fine,
live versus one. Yeah.
Right.
The artists that we would be concerned about are the emerging artists that depend on the road. You know, is that they're still building their name, they have their following, but them being on the road was their primary source of income as they built in the streaming world. Yeah, as they built their catalog, as they built their, you know, all those guys. We can name a bunch of songs by all of those guys that, you know. To fill the Fillmore, you already have to be broken. We call it like breaking music. We call it when a song is broken or artist. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
you know, to an extent, you know.
And which is the thing? So Wizkid is currently on his Made in Lagos tour. He sold out 2 concerts in the DC area, the Fillmore, those 2 concerts.
And he could have sold out 4. You know that?
He could easily have sold out 4 even more. And he's selling out other cities here in the U.S.
In case you're just joining us, we're chatting with Tuma Bassa, Director of Black Music and Culture at YouTube.
Voice of America.
What does that say about the market here and the power of the diaspora music consumer?
Well, you know, Davido said something in a talk at YouTube that was really deep. He said something, and then when you go do numbers, it's real. He says everybody has a Nigerian friend, because we're asking about the rise of Afrobeats. He says everybody has a Nigerian friend, right? And when he said that, I started thinking numbers-wise. There's 300 million Nigerians in Nigeria. There's so many Nigerians in UK, so many Nigerians in Canada, so many Nigerians in the US, Houston, DC, etc. They stay connected. Travel is cheaper, so you can go home more because you can buy these tickets on these websites that sell at bulk price. You have things like YouTube and social media. You have communication tools free, like WhatsApp or iMessage. That's free, so you can keep in touch. You can be up to the minute.
Right.
The social disconnection or the cultural disconnection, I should say, is not what it was in the 80s and 90s for the diaspora, and that makes such a huge difference
right.
in terms of the spread because, you know what I mean? And of the potential, right? And now, yes, Lil Duval did a remix of Essence, right? And then I was at this dinner, and they were playing. They played Aaliyah, then they played Wiz. They played Aaliyah, then Wiz, and then later on they played Focalistic. I was shocked. It was a dinner. And,
it also depends on what kind of dinner. Where were you? Like the context of
it. No, it was all American. All American. It was all American. It was a playlist. It wasn't a DJ. It was like, mm-hmm. I'm talking about the background music. They put Focalistic from South Africa. I blew my mind how the music was just mixing. And it blew my mind. Yeah. And I was like, how do they know about this song?
A couple of years ago, like if you were in a place where all American dinner somewhere, probably playing a whole different set of music.
That never happened. It was very exotic. It was very foreign. Now it's all becoming one, and I love it. Yeah. I love it.
And we're talking about the diaspora community. Also, I think aside from traveling, I think they're putting their money where their mouth is. You know, and they're consuming African cultural products, including the music. And I think, but because of the technology, also, if for example, I know this moment in this concert where Wizkid said, "We're about to play the national anthem of Africa," and in my head, I knew that
you come. Was you like, "Wow"?
Actually, yes. And for me, it feels like any song that is popping in a Jewelegba at that moment, somebody in Houston or in America, in Nigeria, will know about it, or anywhere else in the world. So by the time it becomes mainstream, we kind of already know even the lyrics to it, you know. So that in, you know, the instantness of, you know, that has been accorded to us by technology has really helped you know, people continue connecting with the homeland and the culture. Yeah. It was 2019, I believe, or early 2020 when the news broke that Tiwa Savage had signed with Universal, and we've seen many artists on the continent signing with these big record labels, Universal, Sony, and others. And you know, how has it helped elevate their musical careers? And I guess my question is the music label model still viable in the era of YouTube and other social media platforms, if an artist is able to leverage their social media?
100%. You have to remember something about artists. Artists want their music to be heard. They want their music to be heard by as many people as possible, enjoyed. They love applause. They love things, because when they were creating it, it's their baby. This is the baby. So these labels, what they do is they help scale. Like you can do it all yourself. That's fine, but you're limited in terms of capacity, right? And so these labels, what they do is now you have the potential to reach. It's not a guarantee, but you have the potential to reach other places in the Asian Pacific markets, the Europe, Middle East, Africa. You already have. Then now North America, maybe Latin America, is so the global part is in terms of the music videos or in terms of radio, right? Is that you can focus on your music and your team can focus on, you know, the movements, right? And then what they're focusing on is on what they like to call scaling and making it big
and new markets.
Yeah, breaking. Yeah, exactly.
So the record labels still have those networks already in view.
100%. Of course, you can do it yourself. Yes, 100%. And you can be independent and you get paid more when you're independent if you actually get to a certain place, right? Because you keep more. But getting there is really, really difficult. And then the reason why I'm saying difficult, I'm not saying it's difficult because it's like impossible or hard to do. Is so competitive. You know how saturated the market is? You know how many songs are coming out every day? Right? So how do you break from that excess? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? How do you stand out? Right? Is that partnership or that alignment with those major record labels helps? It's strategic. These are strategic partnerships, you know?
And they're still functional, still working, and still relevant.
It's still relevant, still functional. It's probably a sweeter, more romantic story for the little guy to win and et cetera, in terms of a thing, right? Mm-hmm. I'm being honest. I'm just being honest, right? Mm-hmm. Even me, I root for the little guy. I enjoy music that comes from indies, right? The reality part is that they still have that kind of dominance. But then you have independents like Empire. Have you heard of Empire?
Yes.
Empire Distribution. Oakland. Yeah, exactly. They were Oakland. Yeah. They're not Oakland. They're
San Francisco. Bay Area or somewhere? San Francisco.
San Francisco, not Oakland. I'm sorry. San Francisco. Yeah, so they've been investing a lot in African music. Buju has that song Outside. He's on that song Mood with Wizkid right now. Mm. I'm in a big mood. Na 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 na. Something. Yeah. Buju is on there. I think Burna has his label deal, Spaceship, mm-hmm. with Empire, which is independent. Who else? They have Fireboy, DML. They have. They've been investing a lot. And then
Fireboy DML and Joe Boy are the two artists I feel like were most affected dollar-wise by the pandemic, because their songs were just popping at the time when the lockdowns happened.
Well, this is the deal here. I can't confirm. I have no idea, to be honest with you, right? However, what I do know is that the pandemic did hurt African music. And you know why? I'll tell you why. Festivals. And people were traveling to Africa, going to the Ghanas and these, you know what I mean? And then they were doing travel groups and they were listening. So the travel was hurt. So it slowed down. So right now what we're seeing is like this resurgence, like, okay, there's no more pandemic. Let's go hard, right? To travel, the festivals were booking African artists just as if they were booking a UK artist or a Canadian artist. So there was that. And then also, markets like America are out of sight, out of mind. America music have too many choices that if you're not actually physically here to promote or to be present or to even to politic and, you know what I mean?
To radio.
Or even to navigate, because without that physical presence, you're put at a big disadvantage. Yeah. And then the other thing is this, the last point about why there was some hurt is collaborations in music. When you collaborate, you cross pollinate audiences, right? So if you're not physically here to, you know what I mean, to like even just a bond, because artists, they like vibes, they like chemistry. Like you can do the email thing and the payment thing, et cetera, et cetera. But they like
the energy has to connect.
They energy, you know. Yeah.
In case you're just joining us, we are chatting with Tuma Bassa, director of Black Music and Culture at YouTube, and we are talking about Afrobeats in the context of Wizkid's ongoing global tour for his Made in Lagos album.
Yeah. Which artist currently in Africa, in whether it's in part of the Afrobeat crowd or others, would you say is doing well in terms of leveraging their skill and then their business size? Who's doing business really well, good business?
I love the way Mr. Easy does business. I'll tell you why. I love the way Mr. Easy does business is because he always explains very clearly like why he's doing something, what he expects, what the risks are, and then he'll put you onto I love talking to Mr. Easy. That's the best, like business mind in terms of like business mind, right? He has other businesses like fintech, like the payments, and you know what I mean, or you know, and he'll tell you all about it, et cetera, et cetera. So from a business perspective, I think Diamond Platinums. I'm just looking from the outside. You know, and seeing all the investments he makes in Tanzania, you know, the Wasafi FM and et cetera, and the deals with Pepsi, and you know, and so, and that's more, and that's not from a conversation, that's just more from observation, you know.
I'm sure so many artists will listen to you, me, and say, hey, Jackson, you never asked Tuma about what does it take for me to make it on YouTube as a musician?
Consistency, you know, I mean, first, talent and good music. Like if you don't have either of those, you're limited right there. But the consistency part, the engagement, you know, is building the audience and being regular. That's that discipline of regularity is what separates a lot of.
Do you have to continuously produce music, release music on your platform?
It doesn't have to be music. It could be context. It doesn't have to be. It could be vlogs, or it could be behind the scenes, or it could be a trailer. It doesn't have to be music. That's the beauty of YouTube, is that the one song, there could be so many versions of it. You could even do an acoustic version, a lyric video, or lyric visualize.
Video.
Or,
lyric video.
That's engagement. That's giving someone to look for. You're making it a living, breathing thing rather than just uploading a song and then expecting people to just find it. Like, come on, man. Like,
and,
no.
And so how does the YouTube algorithm work then for you if you're not uploading on a regular basis?
I'm not the right person to ask about how the YouTube algorithm works, but just from my personal experience, my personal experience is that you're rewarded by activity, keeping the algorithm warm, man.
Hey, Tuma, I know we don't want to take your time on Sunday. Thank you so much for chatting with us.
No, thank you.
That was Tuma Bassa, Director of Black Music and Culture at YouTube. Let's take a quick break. We'll be right back.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week. Right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
In case you're just joining us, this is Upfront on the Voice of America. My name is Jackson Vunganyi. Social media giant Facebook has agreed to send their global head of safety to testify before the Senate Commerce Subcommittee on Consumer Protection at the end of this month. The hearing comes after the Wall Street Journal published an article revealing Facebook's own research had shown that its Instagram app had a negative impact on young people's mental health. The New York University Stern Center for Business and Human Rights has published the study titled Fueling the Fire: How Social Media Intensified U.S. Political Polarization and What Can Be Done About It. The report calls for Congress and the Biden administration to mandate more disclosure about the inner workings of the platforms and require that social media platforms share data on their ranking, recommendation, and removal algorithms for researchers and regulators to use. Paul Barrett, who is the deputy director at the NYU Stern Center for Business and Human Rights, co-authored the report. In this second part of my conversation with Mr. Barrett, he tells me that social media companies need to consider adjustments on how they are managed.
Right now, the federal government is suing Facebook, Google, other tech companies under antitrust laws. And the claim there is the companies are simply so big that they're dangerous to the larger economy and society. Mm-hmm. I don't know how those cases are going to come out, but those lawsuits implicitly raise the same question. Are you able to manage this company in its current form such that it's a net positive for society as opposed to a negative?
Mm. And, you know, part of your recommendation, I guess, is that government plays a role in these social media platforms. They're creating their mm-hmm. own. And my question is, how do you make sure that the engagement on these platforms that you're suggesting is more authentic and not about people trying to get more likes or creating a viral moment? What are some of the design changes needed on these platforms to avoid the same mistakes that we're seeing right now?
Yeah, well, starting with the potential government role, right now, the government in this country plays almost no role in overseeing social media. If that makes the social media industry anomalous. I mean, broadcast television and radio are overseen by the FCC. The equity markets, the stock markets are overseen by the SEC. And then you've got the Federal Election Commission, on and on. There is no one body that, as an ongoing, sustained matter, keeps an eye on social media. So that's a starting point. I think we are now at the point where we have to conclude that this industry is not going to self-regulate itself sufficiently, so the government needs to entertain some type of constructive role. And the first step, I think, is for the government to require a much greater degree of transparency, which is to say the government will not have anything to say about particular pieces of content or types of content. In this country, we can't do that. First Amendment, free speech. Facebook is a private speaker in that sense and needs to be allowed to do what it wants to do. But the First Amendment does not stop the government from saying, we want you to disclose how your algorithms work so that we can get a better idea why one person sees one news feed and another person sees a very different news feed. How is it that decisions are made about ranking, recommending, and removing content? And once we had a better idea of just exactly how these automated systems worked, I think we could make much more informed decisions about whether, for example, it's really a good idea to have a whole system of rewards for virality. Is it absolutely necessary to have a system of likes and dislikes, to allow people to necessarily share everything? Maybe there should be more impediments placed before the user, before that person is able to share. I mean, for example, Twitter has already done this to a slight degree. If you go on Twitter and a tweet contains a link to an article and you go to share, retweet that article, before you can retweet it, Twitter asks you, are you sure you want to retweet it even though you haven't read the article yet? Okay, that's a good first step. That should slow people down a little bit, make them think a little bit. I think a lot more experiments along those lines are needed. And the only way to make those experiments useful or potentially productive is for the regulators and the public and everyone to understand better how these systems actually work.
WhatsApp is very popular in Africa, actually, in developing countries. I've seen that WhatsApp has part of its safeguards limited how many people you can share one single story. And I think that is limiting the virality of some of these fake stories. I've been reading that, and I know that Americans are really good at functioning without appeals to power. Is there a private sector solution to this public threat, that, as you say?
Well, in theory, there ought to be. In theory, the major tech platforms could self-regulate more effectively. One of the problems with these platforms, though, is I fear that in their short lives, they're all, in the range of 15 years old or so, that they have become more complicated and more vast than their founders anticipated. And the people running these companies simply don't fully have their arms around them, are not able to deal with all the challenges that they face. I am not in favor of the government taking over the companies or the government dictating how they're managed on a day-to-day basis. No, I think that would be a bad idea and dangerous. But I think if we understood more about how the companies functioned, that would create demands from the public, from political leaders and others, that the companies consider adjustments to how they're managed.
That was Mr. Paul Barrett. He's the Deputy Director of the NYU Stern Center for Business and Human Rights. And with that, we come to the end of our show today. Many thanks to our guests, Tuma Bassa, Director of Black Music and Culture at YouTube, and Mr. Paul Barrett of the NYU Stern School. For more on these topics, remember to check us out at voanews.com/upfront, where you can also catch our previous podcasts. You can catch me on social media. I'm at Upfront Africa or The Upfront Show at VOA Upfront. Until next time, goodbye, everyone.